podcast, how I found the podcast. I think just one day, I think honestly, I was feeling a little bit homesick for Pakistan in a way, if that makes any sense. And just was searching around to see if what podcasts are out there. I think honestly, what I started looking for was a podcast, strangely enough, on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It's a Belt and Road Initiative, and seeing if there's anybody putting stuff out on that. Not really many folks, but as I was doing a search in Spotify, I came across your work. And so started listening.
Hello, friends. My name is Habib Ahmed, and you are listening to Popcord. In each episode of this show, I talk to different people from all parts of the world, and they share their lives and their thoughts with us. We all have one connection in this podcast to Pakistan. Our guest for this episode is Kennedy Horton. Kennedy is an American born in the US, but as a child from the ages of 7 to 15, he lived in Sindh, Pakistan, with his family. Earlier, you heard Kennedy talking about how he found the podcast. Prior to our recording, Kennedy emailed us at Popcord and shared a very kind note. Quote, "Great podcast. I just ran across your Popcord podcast and am enjoying it. As is probably obvious from my name, I'm not part of the Pakistani diaspora, but I grew up in Sindh and am enjoying hearing the different perspectives. Thanks for putting this out there." End quote. After moving out of Pakistan, Kennedy lived in Thailand and China, and he now resides in Ireland. In this episode, Kennedy shares a bit about his life in Pakistan and more. Oh, and one more thing, this episode is also available for listening on YouTube, so feel free to head over to our YouTube channel, Popcord, or find the link on this episode's description to YouTube to watch the video form of this episode. You're still here? Okay, all right then. Let's get started. Let's talk to Kennedy.
Yeah, so my name's Kennedy Horton. I currently live in Dublin, Ireland, but I'm from the U.S., born in Mississippi, lived there until I was about seven, eight, and then moved with my family to Pakistan. So I've got three siblings, two sisters and a brother, and so the four of us with my parents moved to Sindh, so southern Pakistan, to the Sindh province, to first lived in Larkana, so an interior Sindh. Mm-hmm. Most people would know Larkana, if they do know Larkana, because of Mohenjo-Daro. It's ancient ruins that are nearby the city, and then moved to Karachi and lived there for a little while. After Pakistan, spent some time in Thailand, graduated high school there, then went back to the States. Studied Mandarin Chinese and economics and sort of international affairs. Worked for a little while and ended up in the States for a little while, and then ended up in China. Except I speak Chinese, so I was working for a GNC supplements retailer in China, running the business there. And last year, or I guess early this year, came here to Ireland. Been here since.
Okay.
Doing the same sort of job.
And what brought your family to Pakistan?
Yeah, I guess different things. My parents do sort of the NGO humanitarian relief work. And so, I guess the question would be for them, what led them to Pakistan? But we ended up there and then doing that sort of work, again, in the Sindh province mostly.
And then you said you were there when you were 7 years old. That's when you moved to Larkana.
Yeah, I think I was eight, and then I think I just turned eight or so, and then moved to Larkana, lived there for 3 years, and then moved to 3 or 4 years, and moved to Karachi, and lived there. I guess it's three and a half years in both places.
Yeah. So Larkana, I think I already told you Larkana. Again, I don't know much about it either. When I think of Sindh, the only city that pops into my mind is Karachi, right? The biggest city in the whole province. So
that's a shame.
Larkana. Yeah. I checked on Google Maps. It's about 6 hours away, I think, by car. From Karachi. Yeah. So it's not like it's even close, like Hyderabad or, some other relatively nearby city. So even I don't know much about it. And I'm sure a lot of the audience doesn't either, to be honest, especially those of us living outside of Pakistan. Honestly, when we go back, we visit our families, usually closer to the big cities. That's where our families often are. Or if it's not a big city, then it'll be a rural area, probably not Larkana.
Yeah.
But somewhere, and then we're kind of in that vicinity. And then we travel a little bit, but not so much in our own country sometimes, but it'd be good to understand a little bit more about life over there and how you found it. What you remember of it? I know you were a kid, but I'm sure you have some memories.
Lots, right? Lots of memories. One reason people know Larkana is that it's the largest city from where the Bhutto family's from. So Zulfikar Ali Bhutto and then Benazir Bhutto, they're from that area. And so Larkana is sort of their claimed home in a way. It's a really strong PPP presence. And I mean, that was, you know, we got there in 1995, and that was sort of the PPP and the Bhutto family was a very clear influence. We, in fact, we even lived for a while. We lived in rented kind of upstairs of the house of Zulfikarli Bhutto's doctor, who's a bit old. Then his son owned the house that we lived in, and so like it was just, I don't know, that was a big impression. But you know, Larkana is in the middle of the Thar Desert, so it's, you know, it's a dusty town. It's about 150,000 people. I think from yours and my perception now, it'd be slow moving. You know, then there, you know, water buffalo walking through the streets, you know, the old Tonga horse carts, things like that.
Yeah, markets. Right. You know, it's kind of funny, actually, even I've noticed this about Pakistan. You mentioned like a relatively small town like Larkana. We think 100,000, 150,000, even my mom's hometown, I still call it a village. She grew up like 3 hours outside of Islamabad. And that place is called, it's close to Chakwal. It's a little town called Choa.
Okay.
C-H-O-A. And, you know, again, I call it a village, but it's actually 100,000 people. But over here in the U.S., if there's a town with like 30,000 people, we're like, okay, that's actually a city. I'm not saying it's a big city, but it's a relative, you know, it's relatively
legit a city. 30,000, yeah.
What about Karachi? Any memories over there? Which part of Karachi did you live at?
Yeah, I mean, we lived in one of the defense phases for a while, and then in KDA, which is a older part of Karachi. So I guess when I was in Karachi, I went to an international school, so it's a bit of a different experience. Larkana went to a local school, and you know, we are the only foreigners around really for most of the time, so it was it's a much different, and it's just, you know, 130,000 people, but it, you know, feels like a much smaller town.
Yeah.
So I think Karachi probably is mostly focused around school. I was getting to middle school, high school at the time, so it was you know, your life kind of revolves around school.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned 1995, right? I moved to the US in 96 for Pakistan. So I was about 6-7 years old at that time. So, you know, I have my own experience to share there. I remember the first 2 years, I honestly don't know how I passed second grade or third grade. I do not know, because I didn't know any English. I was in ESL, but you know, those things take time to really make an impact. So for the first year, I was learning English, but I was behind on everything. The teacher used to call on me. I had no idea what she was saying. Yeah. The only three words I remember that I knew were yes, no, and hello. Like, those were the only three words. And I remember one time my teacher was right in the beginning. I think they took me into a separate classroom, and they knew I had no clue what they were talking about. But they asked me some questions. I still don't know what to this day what those questions were. All I remember was nodding my head and saying yes, and then no, yes, no. And then they looked at each other like, what is this guy doing? And then that's all I remember. So I don't know how I passed, to be honest. I think I was at risk of getting left back, but that was my experience.
How old were you? You said 6'7"?
6'7", yeah, second grade and third grade.
So, I mean, one of my sons is 7 right now.
Yeah.
And he just learned English this year. Chinese is his mother tongue. And so when he moved to Ireland, he spoke, I don't even think he knew how to say yes. And we're homeschooling now because of COVID and other reasons. But in the beginning, he was in a school. And something interesting I noticed is, I mean, literally understood nothing, right? I mean, absolute zero. He couldn't communicate at all. Again, he didn't even know how to say yes. But he was strangely, so if I was in that situation, I feel like pretty uncomfortable. I feel like quite self-conscious. He was shockingly cheerful, very accepting of the fact he had no idea what was going on, and strangely satisfied with it. Wow. I mean, did you feel like that way at all?
No, I was nervous as hell. No,
it seems like a normal reaction. Okay.
Yeah, I was really scared. I remember my mom dropped me off and on the first day of school, I cried. I cried for a good week. Like, I would cry in front of the teacher. I cried, you know, the students would obviously, not look at me like I'm one of them. You know, it was just a strange experience. It took a while to make friends and stuff. And this was not out there, by the way. This was Brooklyn, New York City. So it was a very diverse school that I went to. Very diverse. There were a lot of other kids in the same boat as me. I remember even like in fifth grade, and by that point I had caught up, obviously. You know, I was well immersed. And this other Pakistani kid was brought into my class, and they brought him in just because I was there. So I was going to be like his buddy to
Cool.
You know, bring him up to speed. Yeah. Yeah. So I was his translator basically. So, you know, I kind of gave him, you know, the ropes and everything and helped him around and, you know, kind of helped him communicate with the teacher back and forth, because again, he was in the same boat as how I used to be in second grade. So this was a very diverse school, but yeah, I was nervous as hell. So it's pretty commendable about your son taking it so relaxed. That's cool.
Yeah. It's a mystery.
I mean, part of it might be, it seems like you've moved around a lot too, right? So China, you said Thailand before that. I'm not sure if your son was exposed to all that, but it seems like you're pretty much on the go throughout your life. So he might have inherited some of that adventurous mindset.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't traveled that much. That was some of his first things. I think he just has a unique personality. That's what it seems like. So
awesome.
I think my reaction would be the same as yours. That seems something I can understand a lot more.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, you know, for you, I was going to kind of try to relate this back to you. You moved to Larkana, you were 7 years old, right? And now you're suddenly in a completely different world. And it's not like a city like Karachi where you can have an American school possibly to go to, right? How was that experience? Do you have any memories? How did you even go to a local school? How did that work out?
Well, there was a, you know, so there's government schools, and then there was a new English medium school that had just opened, really super small. Mm-hmm. I think they just had four classes. Mm-hmm. And so we joined that school. I was in a classroom with maybe 8-9 other students. And so, I mean, just to put in context of what Larkana is like. So this is a private school, mm-hmm. right? But and you're in Sin, it's super hot, right? It's mm-hmm. super hot, but the school doesn't have any air conditioning at all. So it's a private school, but it's still pretty basic. Mm-hmm. Everyone sharing one glass to drink water and stuff, you know, that sort of situation. Mm-hmm.
I remember so that still, too. Yeah.
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 You know, the Muslim glass and then the non-Muslim glass. That's,
I don't remember that, but
you don't remember that? That's
yeah. They had that.
Oh, of course.
They had that? Okay.
Of course.
No, that's surprising to me, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, large, like a cement water cooler, but because we weren't accustomed to drinking after people, we brought water bottles.
That makes sense. Yeah, of course.
As,
yeah.
as one would, but yeah. It's just fun, right? I mean, you're in a small class. We had, I guess, 8 to 10 students. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just kind of hanging out and playing. You're obviously really different being the white kid. I don't know. I have fond memories.
I'm guessing it was not an English school, right? So did you have to learn Sindhi or?
It was an English medium school. So
it was an English medium. Okay.
Yeah, there are lots of people who didn't speak much English that were there. You'd get punished if you spoke Sindhi or Sindhi.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Sindhi speaking, but it was an English medium school. So I took Sindhi class, Islamic class, Urdu class, but classes were in Sindhi.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't a complete, linguistically speaking, it wasn't a complete culture shock, but yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't your experience. Yeah. It wasn't your experience.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure it's still very different, obviously. Again, it's a completely different world. I'm sure you realized that when you got there. Like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah, it's really different, man. It's really different.
Very different. I think as kids, of course, Evan, you're a kid at that age, you don't really question much.
Exactly. All right. You just do it, right?
Yeah, you just do it. It's different. You don't think about the alternatives, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I felt some of that later on in different stages. But yeah, that, you know, 7-8 years old. You're just kind of hanging out, right? You're mm-hmm. just watching. And you know, you having fun with people, so.
Yeah. Do they have like physical punishments? You mentioned punishments.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking back about it, and it was this weird mix of like a level of like wild freedom and mm-hmm. Severe physical punishment. So we had one teacher who used to walk around school with like a 4-foot-inch mm-hmm. inch thick cane and would just mm-hmm. like indiscriminately hit kids. Like sometimes, like absolutely, we have very difficult to understand why, just very strange from random punishment. But then, you know, I had some teachers who were 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
You could do anything with them. I mean, they wouldn't punish. So it was a strange mix. So yeah, there was physical punishment, but there was plenty of messing around too.
Yeah. Was this a public school or a private school, like a government school?
It was a private school.
Okay. So I told you I went to second grade here, right, in the U.S. onwards. But in first grade, I went to first grade in Pakistan. And I remember a little bit of that experience. I remember that one big water, whatever you want to call it, the tank. And it was there was a shared glass tank for everybody. Yeah, yeah. For the whole school, there was a shared glass. You would just drink out of that.
Was it chained on?
Yeah, it was chained on. Yeah.
Yeah. The metal cup chained on.
Yeah. That's funny. It's funny. I thought it was just my school, but I remember that. And I remember drinking out of that too. And, you know, now it's pretty gross now that I think about it. I'm kind of a germaphobe. So that was back then not an issue.
Very bad
but
for you.
Yeah, yeah. And the second thing I remember is getting hit on the hands with rulers. So they were thankfully not too hard on me, but like as a punishment to the whole class, if the class did something naughty, the teacher would go around and hit everybody twice on the hand. Not too hard, but you know, yeah, just to kind of teach us a lesson. So I remember that. But my brothers, my older brothers, they dealt with a lot more. There's a lot of funny stories that came out of that. My oldest two brothers are twins. And they apparently got beat up a lot by, you know, their teachers in high school. And yeah. They tell this story a lot. They went to a government school, so it was not as structured as a private school. You know, there wasn't a lot, you know, nobody really kept an eye or oversaw the teachers. Some of the teachers held grudges on their kids.
Our school is right next to the government school. And so I could hear the screaming and kids literally climbing over the wall. It seemed like it was wild. Absolutely wild. It seemed like a lot of fun.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, it's like a jungle, honestly. And the teachers are like that, too. I'm not saying this is always the case, but this was the case back then in the 90s, at least. That's how my brothers describe it. And anyway, they have one teacher who used to beat the crap out of them. They graduated, they moved on. And then my older brother, who's younger than them, went to that high school. And that same teacher beat him up. And he came home and he told my brothers. My brothers were in college at that point. So they decided, well, one of them decided to get all his friends, like 16, you know, college boys and stuff. And they just went and raided that school. And they just started beating up the teachers. And apparently that one teacher who gave them a really hard time, they picked him up and they threw him down the well.
Wow.
so it was rowdy. Yeah. I mean, all right, guys and girls, in order to maintain some journalistic integrity, I have to clarify some things here, to be honest. I went back to my brothers and I asked them to share the story again, as I hadn't heard it in a while. Did this event take place? Yes, it did. But my brothers were witnesses to this, not actually the players. Apparently, I mixed up two different events. My brother did go with his friends to intimidate the school teachers in a separate instance. And in that situation, they only spoke with the teachers and just made some halagullah and came back home. This particular instance took place separately in their school by much bigger players. They weren't involved in that, unfortunately. Hope that's clarified. Yeah, and then they left. Like, I was like, how did you get away with all that stuff? But this is apparently, this apparently went down in Pakistan. This kind of stuff was all the time, you know, like teachers versus students. Teachers got a gang of their own. The students got a gang of their own. In government schools, that's what happens. And this was in Lahore.
This is Lahore. Okay.
Yeah, it's wild. Yeah, I hope that that kind of stuff doesn't still take place. I think in private schools, they've almost completely removed it in Pakistan. Not a lot of private schools do it anymore. But government schools, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Be a good thing to find out. Yeah, I know. You think about punishment. We were third, fourth, fifth grade. So we're still like, you know, like kids, right? We weren't like high schoolers. We weren't any sort of threat to the teachers. And I guess because a lot of the teachers we had were super young, that sometimes they would like try to, they would use like, you know, like whiteboard erasers, especially the young ladies. They'd hit with like a whiteboard eraser or a ruler and it just wouldn't be effective. And they weren't willing to do something else. And so at some point, I remember we just, a lot of us just stopped listening to them. We had one teacher, I think it was an art teacher, maybe it was an Islamiyat teacher or something. But her punishment was she just resorted one day to the punishment of you get to stand up and put your arms, stand up if you did something wrong. Next step was put your arms out and then stand on your chair. And at one point the whole class was standing up with the arms out and then she made us stand on the chair. I'm not sure what the punishment, why that was a punishment, but we had to stand on our chair and then stand on top of our desk. And like, that was a punishment. The whole class is out there staying on the desk with punishments. And then one of my friends just yells, "What now, teacher? What now?" And she just burst into tears and ran out the room.
There was one punishment called the teacher would tell you to become a chicken. Have you ever heard of that?
Murga.
Become a murga.
I know of other people had to do it. We did. That wasn't one in our school. But yeah, and then walk around the schoolyard.
Yeah, you'd have to grab your ears from under your legs. So bring your arms from under your legs and then grab your ears. And then, try to walk like that.
Oh, I have seen somebody do that at that school. I totally forgot about that. Oh, man.
It's called being a chicken, apparently. Murga bano.
A murga.
Murga, yeah. Yeah, man. So, yeah. I didn't have many school memories there, obviously. You know, I only went for one grade. And then before that, kindergarten. But it's already,
okay.
You know, even those are just enough to laugh about.
Yeah, we had, it's good times, man. Just all kinds of good times.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you kind of subtly mentioned having the non-Muslim class and a Muslim class, right? Now, remember, in our school, I mean, it wasn't an English medium school, but in our school, they did have two classes. I never questioned which one was which or anything, but I wonder now if it had anything to do with that. But, you know, growing up as a Muslim, obviously, in a majority, whether it doesn't matter if you're a Muslim or not, but you're a majority in any country, right? You don't feel these things oftentimes, I think. So, for example, my experience growing up in the U.S. obviously will be a little different from a regular, you know, kind of like a white, Southern Catholic person growing up over here. Because especially in Pakistan, I haven't heard from many people who grew up like outside of the majority. The only minority that I've spoken to is the Shia. They're about 10-20% of the population. Still not that bad. They still have a community. There's Christians in Pakistan. There's Hindus in Pakistan. I don't hear from them much. I haven't found somebody for the podcast yet who is like that. But then you know, of course, you would be another great example of this.
I guess the only other non-Muslims at the school were Hindus. There were a few Hindus. I think the school was, overall is about maybe 80 kids. Mm-hmm. My recollection is about 10 Hindus. And so kind of... So, anyway, just in the background of that. But I mean, of course, you're always sticking out no matter what, right? I'm white. One of the best compliments I got, I don't think I'll ever forget it. I got into a rickshaw one day, and I had a shalwar kameez on, and I was going somewhere. And I was taking both my sisters and a family friend were in the back of the rickshaw, and we were going somewhere. And so I jumped in, I was sitting next to the guy driving, and so I was talking to him where to go, and I was speaking Sindhi to him. I remember him asking me if I was a Pathan, if I was Pashtun.
Because you're so light-skinned, yeah.
Yeah, but at least he's Pakistani. And I thought, wow, this guy thinks I could be Pakistani. Yeah. This is fantastic. Of course, like for him, like that's like super far away. That might be the most foreign foreign person he can imagine being around. But still, like it was a... you know, it felt like you fit in for a minute, right? It felt really good. And I think, I mean, so it's always kind of that sense of like being different and, you know, kind of wanting to fit in, but it, you know, there's so many gaps, right? But but I think people are always super welcoming, super hospitable. We're always at people's houses, eating food, people trying to make us feel welcome and succeeding in doing so. I mean, always felt very, very welcome.
Mm-hmm. So you had a good experience with the locals overall?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah. What did you do in your free time outside of school, like on the weekends and stuff?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we had, we had lots of family friends. We folks we just met in the area, and so we'd go to people's houses for different functions or whatnot. Like I said, we lived in the second story of a larger house, and our landlord lived below, and he had some kids, and so I used to go down. We used to go down there and play with them. Right. And then friends from school would hang out with them. But, you know, I was quite young. So in Larkana, at least quite young. So it was mostly going to family's friend's house, hanging out with my friends or get.
Got it. OK. And I think this is the last question I have about Pakistan. One or two great things about living there that you remember, and then one or two not so great things.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great country. There are great peoples. And, you know, overall great people, and then lots of, you know, people groups that are just fantastic and super interesting that got to meet and be exposed to. And like I mentioned, the hospitality before, I mean, that's just overwhelming hospitality. And so that's super eye opening and how to be hospitable to, you know, like you said, I mean, I come in places where, you know, people maybe are not used to, you know, catering to some folks like my family and didn't have any good reason to except for they wanted to, right? And so that's what a great example and something to learn from. Things I miss. I mean, I miss food, right? Yeah. I miss food an incredible amount. I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
In fact, we found, so there's a great Karachi restaurant barbecue tonight. Uh-huh. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
Yeah. They are. Okay. I'm not sure if it's a chain, but there was one in Texas actually where I lived, barbecue tonight. But I'm not sure if it's a chain. So.
Well, a guy from Lahore opened one here in Dublin, and so I was super excited when I found it. Get some good halim or whatnot. It, you know, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing great about Pakistan is the geography. So, like, you know, we're down in the desert, right? The desert has its own type of beauty, but it's certainly an acquired taste in many ways. But if you go up north and you just get fantastic and incredibly, you know, just incredible vistas, it's just you know, go to Hunza, the Hindu Kush, around the mm-hmm. Pamir Knot, or, you know, up in that area. It's just, it's incredible, right?
So you traveled all that, meaning you weren't just sitting in one place. That's good. You actually went around.
Yeah, I mean, when we first got to Larkana, we flew into Islamabad.
Yeah.
We spent maybe a month or so in Islamabad and up to Nathia Gully and Murray, mm-hmm. so up in that area.
Oh, wow.
And mm-hmm. then we bought a car, Zuzika Bolan, a little van, and then drove down to Larkana. And so, you know, that trip, so it was right when we got there, it's about a 3-day trip.
Yeah.
So got to see a good bit, you know, stop in Multan and places like that, you know. So immediately got to see a number of spots. And so then throughout the time there, you know, traveled to Islamabad a ton, up, you know, way north of Islamabad, Lahore. Mm-hmm. The thing I regret is I've never been to Baluchistan or any of those areas. Yeah. And right. that's most of my family has, but for whatever reason, I didn't get to make it out there. Go. So mm-hmm. love to go to Quetta.
I'll go someday. Absolutely. Yeah. Me too. Honestly, I've never been to Baluchistan either. So it's one of the overlooked provinces, actually. It's the largest province by size, actually, in Pakistan. But not many people go as much. So it doesn't get as much visibility or spotlight in the media either. Most of the focus is often on Punjab and some parts of Sindh.
And usually when it gets media, it's always for not pleasant reasons, since we have a lot of
a lot of the political tension comes up a lot, especially nowadays, I think, last few years. What about the one, two things that you did not like so much? And it's completely okay, by the way. I'm not gonna shoot you or anything like that for being open. I'm completely open to hearing your thoughts.
I think growing up in a place where, like, your family's not from, and Pakistan mm-hmm. I think society is very strong in a country like Pakistan, and government's mm-hmm. much weaker, right? A lot of mm-hmm. like life revolves around familial ties, other societal ties. Mm-hmm. It's just very apparent. It's much different than the U.S., where like a political identity is super important, way more important than society in many ways. And so like you're always the outsider mm-hmm. in a place like that. It's just more and more apparent. And so, you know, that's just, it's not always pleasant. And so that's nothing to do with Pakistan, really, I guess. That's just the fact that I was a obvious foreigner mm-hmm. tooling around. So that's one thing. And this, it's growing up in a place like Larkana, it's something I'm very thankful for, but it's complicated. But seeing poverty mm-hmm. right along with wealth and sort of seeing that disparity, I came from, I come from the U.S. Like there's lots of security there. And you, very apparent, and met lots and lots of people just don't have sort of that financial or whatever security. And so mm-hmm. I think as a kid, that can be tough to see, but it's a real world. So it's also mm-hmm. good to see.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, some of the things I've seen in Pakistan are unimaginable sometimes over here. Like I remember one time when I was like 10 years old, seeing on the streets this guy, you know, kind of a disabled guy. His legs mm-hmm. weren't working. Now, he didn't have a wheelchair. He was on some type of like mat type thing, like some kind of wood board. And then he was dragging himself on the street with his hands. Like, so he was basically on his stomach and he was dragged. I was like, again, as a 10-year-old, I was kind of traumatized to see that because I wasn't used to even those few years in living in the U.S. But keep in mind, 10 years is not that long. You know, my life is still getting shaped. So I hadn't seen much of disability in general, but then on top of that, to see that and then come back to the U.S. and be able to compare it to, you know, I started noticing more of the treatment of disabled people and similar types of folks over here. And it was like, you know, night and day. I was like, that starts getting you interested in why those facilities don't exist always in some countries or some places.
Yeah, it's heavy, right? That's a heavy thing for a 10-year-old to see. And then, like, you say that. I remember seeing a man, we saw people like that frequently, right? And it's heartbreaking. And then I see, at sort of a different level, I remember seeing a man sort of position someone who's disabled mm-hmm. to beg in a good spot. Because mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. were presumably part of some sort of begging ring, right? And so this disabled person is getting taken advantage of in a even a different way than is apparent at first, and just sort of, you know, being aware of that that can be heavy for a kid.
Yeah, not a lot of focus on that.
It's truth, right? I'm fortunate that you know, it's not real. It's not actual. It's not my own experience. Right. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
There's a lot of very real suffering going on.
Absolutely. You moved out of Pakistan to Thailand, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Which year was that?
It was, we were in Karachi in 2001 when 9/11 happened. And so we had to leave Karachi for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
So finished 2001 outside of Karachi and actually in Thailand, came back in 2002, January, and were there up through July or so. So the summer of 2002. And that was right when, you may or may not remember that sort of tensions between India and Pakistan were getting really hot. I mean, it was tensions were high.
Sorry, you mentioned 9/11. Was there something that pushed you out of there from Pakistan due to that?
There, we were Americans, right? Living in Karachi, yeah. Openly, we didn't, there were some folks that lived in compounds or whatnot. You know, we didn't live that way. I guess our organization, I don't think my parents wanted to leave, but our organization asked that we leave the country for a little while until we knew what was going to happen. So I think within 24 hours of the 48 hours of the towers falling, we'd gotten a flight and gone to Thailand just to wait to see what had happened.
Yeah. Okay. So then you ended up moving to Thailand 2002, I think you mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which part of Thailand were you in?
We're in Chiang Mai in the north.
Okay. Yeah. How many years were you there?
So I think I did my 10th, 11th, and 12th grade high school years there, so 3 years.
In Thailand, okay.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned China after that. You've really been around, so it's really interesting to talk about your timeline. It's Pakistan to Thailand, and then...
It's back in the U.S.
U.S.
Yeah, I was back in the U.S. for school, went to undergrad, grad school, worked for a few years, and then in 2016, I went to Shanghai. Yeah, moved to Shanghai. Was there until 2019 and came here to Ireland.
Yeah. And then Shanghai, it was mostly for work, I'm guessing, right? For GNC.
Yeah, it was for work. Yeah. So during my undergrad years, I lived in a couple different cities in China studying Chinese Mandarin.
Yeah.
But didn't really live there after that until I moved there for work. You know, and the deal with Pakistan is I was a little kid when I was there and about eight years old, about 15 years old. So those are formative years, right? So there's just a tie there that's different than other places. I'd say in Pakistan, it's, folks are incredibly warm. People are incredibly warm and food is wonderful. And you feel tied to a very long history, at least certainly in Sindh. You feel tied to a very long history all the time. Negatives, society is not quite as open, right? For reasons I just mentioned before, as maybe other places. It's not as easy to get around, especially, sisters and my mother. It's not as easy to get around in many cases in conservative areas of the country. Thailand's just an easy place to be. I don't know if you've been there, but I'm sure you don't need to be told. It's an easy place to travel or hang out. It's kind of
very accessible.
Big part of the economy is tourism, so it's an easy place to be. But for me, I don't have deep connections to Thailand at all. So it's a nice place to be, but not a deep tie-in. And then China, I love China. I enjoyed living there. I'll probably live there again. Both my boys are Chinese, and I speak Chinese. And it's an exciting. I think the deal with China right now is it's an exciting place to be. There's been so much change the last couple decades.
Yeah.
That people have seen so much change, like quality of life change in their lifetime, just new things. That's just an expectation that things will change in the future. It's an expectation that I can't really see what's going to happen. And there's a freshness and newness to that. It's fun to be a part of. Mm-hmm. So if you speak Chinese, it can be, in my opinion, if you can speak Chinese and kind of see some of those things, it can be very fun, a ton of fun, and just super, super interesting.
Super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chinese is one of the up and coming languages, I think, of the future, especially for business. They say it's actually really beneficial to learn some Chinese.
Yeah. Up. It may be here. It may be here already. It'll be.
Yeah. Exactly. I think so. Yeah. Not just the future. But it's a tough language to pick up, right? It's a difficult language.
Oh, they're all tough. They're all tough.
Are you fairly fluent in Chinese and? In Mandarin?
I mean, I am. So I can work and operate in Chinese. So when I guess I work basically exclusively in Chinese. So it's, whatever that means. Sorry, yeah, professional efficiency.
Okay, last question I had for you, Kennedy, was how do you look back on Pakistan now? Not necessarily your time spent over there, but you mentioned, of course, you were looking at China, Pakistan, the, you know, the economic corridor, CPEC. How do you look at the country now?
Yeah. Yeah, so I haven't been back in 15 years. I took a friend there 15 years ago, right, mm-hmm. at the year I graduated high school, and we went to, you know, Hyderabad, Karachi, Larkana. Travel run is wonderful, and I will go back. I want to take my wife and my kids when we're kind of stabilized a little bit. When the world opens up, maybe in a couple of years, it'd be perfect.
That's great.
But how I look, I mean, I feel like it's an underrated place, mm-hmm. in terms of, like, I guess in two ways, in terms of like the warmth and sort of the special nature of the people that live in Pakistan, and then two, I mean, it's an influential country. It's a huge country, you know, probably be top six in terms of population in 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And then it's sitting between, and then, you know, for years it sat between Afghanistan and India when Afghanistan was the hotbed of, you know, just a big focus. And now we're seeing Pakistan playing, a role with China and India. I mean, it's just an important place, no matter how you look at it, but it's definitely not something that's on people's radar.
Yeah. Yeah. Oftentimes. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I feel like it's very much underrated in that way. So I guess past 15 years, some sadness. I've seen some things happen. Mm-hmm. Hope, you know, I'm excited. Like, I was looking at CPEC. I was interested in CPEC because there's a lot of good investment in infrastructure to be put in the country, and that gives me lots of hope. And so I keep an eye on that. I'm interested to see what happens.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's a way I can get involved. I would like to, but yeah. Interesting yeah, to see what yeah. happens. One thing just came to mind. I was talking to a friend in Karachi, maybe like four or five weeks ago, someone I went to school with, and we were talking about Hunza, and he had just gone for the first time in his whole life. He's always been in Karachi. He's just not left much. And I've been a bunch. I just assumed other people had gone, but to your point, you know, people travel to varying degrees, right? And it's just such a wonderful area. But I remember last time I went to Hunza, every time I've been there, and I've been maybe 5-6 times, you know, it involves, at one point involves like a 16 to 20 hour bus ride up the KKH, in the ways that I went. And that's a, you know, it can be a fun bus ride, but it can be quite harrowing. Like, I remember one time did an all night bus ride, made some stop in the middle of the night. And these roads are tiny. I mean, and just, you know, winding upright. But we got out, it's like 1 a.m., got out, threw some water on our faces from a nearby stream. And the bus driver calls everybody around, and he has this big torch, you know, big flashlight. And he's on the side of the road, and he's pointing everybody to look down. And there's just a bus like ours laying on its side, charred. And he said, this happened two nights ago. Everybody died. Back on the bus.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're supposed and to be calm
just
about
like
it.
We're like all bleary eyed, and we're just like, what? Oh, okay. Get back on the bus. Mm-hmm. And like, I remember, like, that's how we traveled every time up there. But when I was talking to this buddy, he was telling me how much investment's been put in roads and hotels in the area. And it's just, it seems like the past 5 years, there's just so much change up there. It's such a much different place. And that makes me excited.
Yeah.
You know, there are campaigns to get tourists up to Hunza, you know, domestic tourists, you know, within Pakistan itself, to get up to Hunza and get up to those areas. And, you know, that's exciting. People should go see Gilgit. They should have gone seen Gilgit a long time ago. And it's good that money's being put in. And that gives you a lot of hope, right? A lot of pride. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, yeah, it's absolutely good to see. Last year was a pretty good year, I think, for Pakistan in terms of tourism. It got a lot of spotlight, actually. There were a lot of YouTubers, vloggers going to Pakistan, you know, like non-Pakistanis. It was getting a lot of coverage, actually. So that was pretty good. This year has been, I think, slower, mostly due to COVID, not a lot of traveling going on in general. So it's been kind of a sad year for traveling in general across the world. But yeah, Pakistan's been doing pretty well, I think, relatively speaking, versus 10 years ago or so, when the borders were like almost completely closed and, you know, kind of the war of the world was at its peak. It kind of limited traveling to Pakistan and nearby countries quite a bit. That's gotten gradually a lot better.
Well, I mean, I think domestic travel's been up this year, at least it seems like. I know a guy runs a sort of a new, like a tech startup travel agency. So a travel agency, but a tech startup that does travel. I think they're up 30% year over year just because of COVID, right? For just domestic travel.
Just for domestic,
They're getting killed on international, of course, but domestic is up. So hopefully, hopefully spark more more internal movement and get more investment, which would lead to more tourism. Because there, I mean, there's, like I said, wonderful places to see and wonderful people to meet. So
yeah,
I'll have to go back soon.
Yeah. Pakistani, conversations can be pretty interesting. You mentioned that bus incident. I think I've never seen a bus fall, but people used to mention it a lot. And in my mom's hometown, where she grew up, is a very mountainous region. And I would say, thankfully, not as bad as the ones up there and around Hunza or North Pakistan in general, but still pretty bad. There will be really twisty and windy roads. I remember I was a kid, so I used to throw up, get nauseous. Yeah. Very difficult drives. Very, very difficult. And yeah, you'd look right outside your bus window or your car's window. And then, yeah, there was your tire and there was maybe like a foot of road. And then that's it. It's down. There's no fencing. Very few places.
Those guys drive with abandon.
Yeah. It was crazy. You know, those little Bedford trucks, those trucks, those decorated trucks. Yeah. Those don't often really have really powerful engines. So they're like struggling to go uphill and they're carrying a ton of weight on them, right? Cement and whatever, bricks. And remember, yeah, these guys would be really struggling on some of these hills because we lived on a hill too, our house over there.
Oh, so you just see them go by.
Yeah. You see some of them get stuck, and then what they do is like one guy would get out and put a brick behind the truck's tires so that it would not roll back. And then they keep trying,
like,
and
eventually
Yeah. It was insane. Yeah. But again, back then, you know, it was kind of normal to see that. But the whole what the bus driver said, like, these guys just died 2 years ago. Two days ago. You know, it's really sad, but it's also kind of dark. It makes me think of some of our talking styles are very direct sometimes, and it comes off as dark. Like, for example, there was a funny joke about this that somebody was mentioning about how Pakistani people talk, and one of them was like, if you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you, well, you have high cholesterol or something, right, or high blood pressure, and you go and you tell your friend might be like, hey, why are you so worried? And you'd be like, well, you know, my doctor said I have pretty high blood pressure, so I need to start taking control of my body and myself. Then your friend would be like, is that a motivating you or anything? Your friend would be like, dude, I just knew somebody who died a week ago from high blood pressure. And it's like, what? Is that supposed to help me out?
Sounds awful.
Yeah. You know, like, my dad just got diabetes. Oh, really? Okay. My uncle just died from diabetes 2 weeks ago. And so it comes off pretty dark.
that reminds me, my dad was on a PI. So we used to fly these 44-seater Fokker airplanes and fly Karachi to Larkana. And so we, you know, that's how we oftentimes went back and forth.
Yeah.
And my dad was on one time. So he's by himself. So this is his story. But he said that turbulence is really bad. Those aren't the best planes. And they would just keep dropping. And you're just like, I don't know, 100 feet, like, ridiculous, just drop, like, stomach in your throat, like, type of drop. And it was just rattling, just crazy, crazy, like, unnerving him. And he's been on all types of flights.
Yeah.
And he said the co-pilot came out and, came out and came into the aisle and said, excuse me, we're experiencing a lot of turbulence during a storm, but what can I do? And turn around and back in. You're like, what are you doing? What was the point of that message? Just letting maybe everybody
somebody
know.
Yeah, somebody asked him. Yeah, somebody probably asked him. That sparks a lot of memories. I don't know if you know Dave Chappelle. He's one of my favorite comedians.
Yeah, yes,
I watch him a lot. He was mentioning something that I related to a lot. He's like, you know, you're on a flight and there's turbulence and you get kind of nervous, right? And I know I'm kind of a nervous flyer too. And I've flown a lot. But if I don't fly for a few months, and then I fly again, and then turbulence hits, I get nervous. You know, I have kind of an anxious personality. But then the first thing you do is you look at the flight attendants, and usually they look pretty calm. You know, they're just walking around or they're just sitting down, but they look pretty calm. And, you know, you look at them and you're like, okay, she probably knows what's up and she's probably deals with this all the time. So this is probably nothing out of the ordinary. I'll survive, right? You know, I'll be fine. And that gives you some comfort. But then if the flight attendant is freaking out, you know, she's just like, there was one YouTube video that went viral. It was like the pilot started telling everybody to start praying because of turbulence. But you know, like, I was like, if I was on that flight, I know as a Muslim, it's good to probably say some prayers anyway, and have some faith that you'll be fine.
So it's different at being good to say a prayer to being instructed to by the guy flying the airplane. This is a very different thing.
Yeah, exactly. A pilot should probably not be saying that. I'd be freaking out.
Love, I enjoyed hearing the story of your brother's raiding the school.
There's
something I love about it, but it's interesting. It reminds me of, I'm telling you, man, like that school next to us, you just see like, they're also older than us. So we're like these little fourth graders looking up and you see these hands come across and these kids climb over the wall. And sometimes they jump and run.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you'd be like, what's going on in there?
It's like an asylum. It's like an asylum. You're screaming out of there.
Well, they'd have their orange sour kameez on and they'd be like, you know, they're like 15, 16 years old. So like little men to, I mean, they're like huge men to us. And we're just like, what?
Yeah. Those kids are hardened. Yeah. They're very hardened. They're living a tough life. So you got to be tough or you get crushed. Yeah. Awesome. Hey, well, thanks, Kennedy. I'll be in touch next few weeks. Great talking to you. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah. Enjoy your holiday, man.
Yeah. You too. All right. Take care. Bye.
Cheers.
Just a quick request before we log off. Have you been listening to Popcord for a while and enjoying it? Or are you a first-time listener? If you enjoy Popcord, we'd love to get your support on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/popcord and sign up to keep this podcast running for as long as possible. If you're a new listener and would love to hear more, remember to hit subscribe and follow us on Instagram or Twitter. See you next time. Khudafiz.